welcome to Anomalous Waves, a podcast discussing all things strange. I'm John.
I'm Ami.
And this is Lilliput.
And today I will be discussing some gray man stories and some marsh legends.
Ooh, gray man, I like that. And I started getting down a rabbit hole of these kind of cemetery ghoul type figures. Some call them vampires. Some call them phantoms. But today, I'll be starting with some that I read about in Virginia. Don't forget to check the show notes for our references for today's episode. We'll have some links to different articles or books that we talk about, as well as all of our info. If you want to follow us on Instagram, you can do that at Anomalous Waves. If you want more from Anomalous Waves, you can go to patreon.com/anomalouswaves.
If you have a spooky or fun story to share with us, go ahead and send it to us on Instagram or shoot us an email at anomalouswaves@gmail.com.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Anomalous Waves.
Now, the gray man is something I learned about from TikTok, and I think I was really excited when I saw it, and I went immediately to tell you about it. It is a legend from South Carolina around Pawleys Island. Mm. Now, gray man stories have been told for over a century. He is a shadowy figure who appears on the beach before a major hurricane, and it is said that those who spot him are spared from harm. Mm. Yeah, he's kind of like a little protector. So the gray man usually never speaks. He just walks the shore and then fades with the wind and sea spray. I found a few local lore stories that say he is a sailor who died at sea and was never able to return home, or that he is the ghost of Pawley's first settler owner named George Pawley.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Namesake.
I also found another version of the story from a news station in Charleston called Count on News 2. He was a young man who had been at sea for a very long time, and he was traveling from Charleston to see his beloved to ask her to marry him. Now, the man wanted to beat an approaching storm, so on horseback, he took a shortcut through the marsh just outside Pawleys Island. As the sun began to set, his horse became bogged down in pluff mud. So pluff mud is kind of like quicksand. Because when I heard that, I was like, what is pluff mud?
Oh, it makes me think of Neverending Story. It's a really sad scene.
So when the horse got bogged down, it threw the man to the ground, and the water and thick mud entrapped him and pulled him under the surface, killing him. So devastated by the death of her beloved, the young woman began to take regular walks on the beach to kind of clear her mind. She started to see a figure standing in her usual path, though. It was a familiar man dressed in all gray. Mm. As she approached the figure, she saw that he had the face of her lost love. Now, the woman asked who the man was, and in this version of the legend, he actually speaks. Mm. He told her to leave the island. A big storm was coming, and then he vanished into thin air.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Harbinger.
Harbinger of doom.
But kind of warning also.
So the woman ran home, and she told her family what had happened, and they believed her. The family decided to just heed the warning. They quickly gathered all their important belongings, and they left to head inland. Now, shortly after, the area was hit by a powerful hurricane, and it left one home completely untouched. Hers.
Wow.
Yeah. In some stories, this harbinger of doom will reveal himself to certain people and warn them to leave before the storm hits. Now, those who see him come home to find that their property is untouched from the passing storm.
Really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they always heed his warning. They leave. And if they listen to him, it seems like then they're spared.
And their house is spared.
Yeah, their house is spared.
Because they're not even there. Mm-mm. Wow.
In some recent sightings, a woman claims to have seen the ghost before Hurricane Hazel in 1954. Another one, someone saw him before Hurricane Hugo in 1989. And the most recent was Hurricane Florence in 2018. But I wasn't able to find if their homes were spared.
Mm. So interesting. Is it always just directly hurricane related?
Usually hurricane related, natural disaster.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. During my research, I happened to come across a number of wetland legends. In case you're unfamiliar with wetlands, they are an ecosystem that is flooded by water either permanently or seasonally. So there is a really scary legend of marsh people from Cape Cod.
Ooh, marsh people.
They are dark, human-like creatures, not shadow people or phantoms, but solid figures that come out of mud.
Mm. That makes me think of a Goosebumps episode.
So Derek Bartlett, important to note that he is a former Marine, and he is the founder and president of the Cape and Islands Paranormal Research Society. Now, Derek states that the legend of the marsh people can be traced back to the 1800s. Mm. Reports say creatures black as marsh and mud emerge to drag a horse or even a human to their doom into the muddy marshes.
So once again, horse.
Yep.
Getting pulled down into the muck.
Mm-hmm. So Bartlett even had an encounter while he was living in a town called Barnstable.
Mm-hmm.
Bartlett had property that backed up against a marsh. And it was like April in 2002. It was during evening, so kind of dusk. And he decided just to kind of watch the marsh with a night vision scope. And he says, I saw what appeared to be people walking, but it wasn't on the railroad tracks that cut through the middle. I stood and watched and watched. They were very light, and then they vanished. It was high tide. They weren't in a canoe. They were walking. I saw the movement of people walking, and then they were gone. I lost focus, and by the time I went back on them, they were just completely gone.
Might have saw the marsh people.
Yeah. And then Bartlett told another story of a group of five kids. He said they were from a large family, and they were just great kids, kind of honest, and they wouldn't lie. The kids were hanging out down by the end of the marsh, and all five of them saw this thing come out of the marsh. They came out, walked across the railroad tracks, and went down the other side. This isn't the kind of thing that kids make up. These sightings are said to happen only every 5 years. Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know why just this area of Cape Cod, but, I mean, he's a former Marine, so one of those very serious kind of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So, moving on to Massachusetts, there is a thing called Bridgewater Triangle. It is way too weird to cover in one episode.
Mm.
We've kind of briefly talked about it. If you really want to dive into the Bridgewater Triangle, the podcast Morbid covers the spooky topic and really does great at capturing all its high strangeness. So I'll try to briefly explain what it is and the connecting lore. So Bridgewater Triangle is an area of about 200 square miles, and it has been the site of legends and curses for centuries. So it is home to some phenomena like ghosts, Bigfoot, UFOs, and just tons of strange creatures. So one of the creatures who calls the forest home is called the Puckwudgie.
Mm, I've heard of them.
Have you heard of them? I found that the Wampanoag and the Algonquin tribes are said to share the legend of the Puckwudgie, along with many other tribes across the U.S. and Canada.
Mm.
Now, the reason why, I'll get into that later. Why it can just be found just vastly across the U.S. Puckwudgie are troll-like creatures who are about 3 to 4 feet tall with smooth, hairy, gray skin and large ears. And they kind of have human-like features, but some of them say kind of like a canine nose and long fingers.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Its personality can differ from tribe to tribe. This version of the troll is more mischievous, and the Wampanoag say that the Puckwudgie can either be a helpful creature or more mischievous or evil. It can steal children and then do harmless tricks, but then just do something atrocious after.
That's like a common thing across, you know, like Irish folklore and stuff too. The brownies and stuff we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
They can be really helpful. You leave an offering, or maybe they'll just be mischievous.
Yeah, sometimes there's nothing you can do. It's just like, nah, I don't like you.
They all have their own personalities.
Yeah.
This is like a group of things, right?
Yes.
It's not like one thing.
Yeah. No, it's a group of things. Legend has it that these creatures originally were very friendly with humans. But humans got distracted by their relationship with Mowship, who was a kind-spirited deity. He created the landmass we now call Cape Cod. Mm. Mm-hmm. So the Pukwudgies got very jealous and upset that they weren't as loved as Mowship, and they began to cause more and more mischief. After the Wampanoags had a talk with Mowship's wife, he exiled the Pukwudgies and forcefully spread them far and wide throughout North America, which is why we can find them throughout so many different tribes.
Mm.
I guess you can find stories from Delaware to Massachusetts, Texas, to even Indiana.
Wow.
Yeah.
And always like gray,
mm-hmm.
long fingers.
Yeah.
Troll-like.
Yeah.
Are they ever invisible?
Not that I've found, okay. But there is something weird in one of the sightings.
Okay.
So many of the Pukwudgies found their way back home to their homelands, and they decided to instigate a very terrible relationship with the tribe and Mowship, and they actually ended up killing five of his sons.
Five of Mowship's sons?
Yeah, five of Mowship's sons.
Mowship's like a deity, but has kids?
Mm-hmm.
Right on.
Yeah. One of the first mentions of Pukwudgies in literature came from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's poem, The Song of Hiawatha, which refers to the mischievous Pukwudgies. And in this poem, they kill the giant by pelting him with pine cones.
Oh. Pine cones. Back pine to cones. Pine cones. That's something that always pops up. You know what also, when you're describing these, sounds very similar also to Perkton. So Perkton would roll with the Perkton, and mm-hmm. it was like small, like troll-like animal creatures.
Oh.
You can find them in the movie Krampus.
Okay.
You know, like his little elf guys.
Yeah.
That's like Perkton. And that there's good Perkton and there's bad Perkton.
Mm-hmm.
Or ugly Perkton, I think they would call them. But it sounds similar also. Yeah.
And some of the photos I saw of them, it looks more like a hedgehog to me. Because some of them looks like they have little spiny backs.
Ooh.
Yeah. There are some, well, fairly recent sightings of the Pukwudgie. This one happened in the 1990s. A woman named Joanne claims she was walking her dog in the forest on a spring day. And her dog ran off the path and dragged her into the woods. When the dog finally stopped, she found herself staring at a strange little being standing on a rock. She described him looking like a troll. He was 2 feet high with pale gray skin and hair on his arms and the top of his head. His torso made up the majority of his body and he had very short legs. His eyes were deep green and he had large lips and a long, almost canine nose. She stared at him for seemed like a while, and then her dog pulled her away back on the path and she quickly left. Later that night, while in bed, she heard a tapping on her window. She woke up, looked outside, and she saw the Pukwudgie staring at her. The nightly visits didn't stop until she moved out of the country.
Oh my god, and see, that sounds like Hopkinsville Goblin-ish. And oh, man, so much stuff.
I know. I don't know what I would do. I think I'd try to trap him, though, if he kept coming back every night. I'm like, you know what? You're going to make this your home now.
Eventually, you would always, I imagine you'd always be scared, but eventually you would get to the point where you're like, okay, now you're a nuisance.
Yeah. Maybe he didn't mean any harm, though. So another sighting is from a man named Tom who saw a Pukwudgie when he was a teenager. He had snuck out of his parents' house one night to walk in the woods, and as he walked down a path, he saw a glowing light. He says, "I noticed a dim light, like in the form of a ball in front of me, It was white and swelled, like it was breathing. It rose to about my shoulders and then flew into the woods. Now Tom followed the light down the path until it disappeared. As he turned to head back home, he noticed he was not alone. A short man, covered entirely in fur, stood nearby. He was about 2 feet tall and he had a canine-like nose. The creature ran off into the trees and let out an unearthly moan. It's so scary.
All this stuff you found has so many, you know, the crossing lines and all the other stuff.
It reminded me of the kind of ball thing that my dad saw on Yakima Nation.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, the mystery light. And I looked up just to look up a picture and kind of see how it's spelled and stuff. And there's some, just at the top, it says there's some other spelling translated by someone named Henry Schoolcraft. Don't know who that is. And it's translated as little wild man of the woods that vanishes.
Oh.
So, I mean, the stories you just read could turn into a light, sounds like.
Yeah.
Could turn into all sorts.
A light and yeah. None of the ones I could find by the local tribe say anything about it vanishing into thin air.
Right on.
But it just seems to run into the wild and then you don't see them. So maybe that's what it means.
Totally.
It can just quickly escape. Yeah.
Not like it went into a mist or something right in front of him.
It just vanishes back into the wild. So Tom had another encounter with a Pukwudgie. One night, Tom drove to one of the Freetown State Forest parking lots. He turned off the engine and the headlights, and he turned down the radio, and he was just enjoying the solitude. But soon after he arrived, he knew he wasn't alone. Standing in the darkness, staring at Tom, was the same little man he had seen in the woods. The Pukwudgie was about 20 feet away, and he could see its eyes glowing red in the night. Abruptly, the engine of Tom's car came on its own accord, and the radio suddenly started to blare loudly. In a panic, Tom just drove home as fast as he could.
Oh my gosh, I started hearing a ring in my ear too, right when you said that. Electrical interference, tapping on windows, mystery lights. Yeah. Good work. Excited.
The Pukwudgies are pretty infamous to this day, and police in Freetown, Massachusetts have put up a Pukwudgie crossing sign near the Freetown State Forest.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So as you can tell, this has been quite the fun trail down marsh and gray legends. I hope to come across more. And the Pukwudgie gets a 10 out of 10 on the cryptid cutie scale. It is a very saucy-like hedgehog.
So, just like I did with episode 16, Mayday, Mayday, I once again decided to just completely switch directions and insert some randomness into my research. This time, I took a book that I had just found at Goodwill called The Ghosts of Virginia, Volume 2 by L.B. Taylor Jr. I flipped it to a random page and just slammed my finger down. And even though I was in a ghost book, the section that I just flipped to was about vampires in Virginia.
What?
So I was like, yeah, I'm going there. I'm going that way. One of the first interesting stories is about an account that took place in the 1890s in and around a place known as the Big Stone Gap, which is a town in the southwestern part of Virginia.
Okay.
This began when a farmer found two prized cows slaughtered in his field. So what made this strange was that the only parts left behind in the field were the head and the hindquarters.
What?
And it was completely drained of blood.
Okay.
Exsanguination.
It's always cattle.
Yep. Listen back to episode 5 for more cases like this. Then it started happening to even more domesticated animals. It wasn't specific in the book, but I'm going to guess other farm animals, probably dogs. So the town centered their suspicion around, of course, like the town hermit, a European man who came to Virginia, like a lot of other people, for the mining and the possibility of, like, you know, fast, extreme wealth. The name just, it just says Rupp, but R-U-P-P, was said to live outside of town in a log cabin and was rarely seen in town. Suspicion arose after two boys claimed they went to his cabin, looked in the window, and saw him eating a huge chunk of raw meat. And that it looked like the leg of a cow. So it said that, you know, the town folk demanded his arrest, but the sheriff was like, we don't have any evidence. We just have these two boys talking about him eating some raw meat, which is not illegal, which is strange, but not illegal.
Might be a weirdo, but
you can eat raw meat and that's okay. Then the town drunk went missing and he was later found dead in the woods, completely drained of blood and missing an arm and a leg. He was found about a quarter mile from Rupp's cabin.
They always go after the town drunk first.
Yeah, exactly.
Always.
So there's another common one next. So still no action was taken. Then a second man, a traveling salesman, was found dead in the woods, drained of blood, with limbs missing near Rupp's cabin. Vigilantes of the town got their torches, got their pitchforks, and they went to his cabin one night. It was unlocked. They went in, and it was just a gruesome scene. Blood everywhere, body parts everywhere, and just right when they went in, just hit with a terrible smell. And people in the book, it says, ran outside retching, you know, because it was so gnarly. And they didn't find Rupp, so they burned that cabin down. The next day, they went looking for him with a big search party, but he was never found. And stories of seeing him around the woods are still told in Big Stone Gap today. So, I mean, if that story's accurate, could have just been a real serial killer.
Yeah.
Also, could have been someone suffering from lycanthropy.
Yeah.
If they're eating raw meat and stuff. Or maybe a vampire. Like a lot of weird things, we find exsanguination, the draining of blood, and missing parts, which is something so common in cattle mutilation cases. And so I thought that was super interesting. I didn't go anywhere else for that story, just the book, because that's what I flipped to. The author went on to explain these letters they received from a man named John Gary Bowes of Richmond, Virginia, years ago. He talks about some personal stories, but he also mentions Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond, Virginia, not in Hollywood, and the gravesite of W.W. Poole. Now, this tomb is massive and covered in white granite with, like, little statues of goats or lambs on it, and all it says is W.W. Poole and the year 1913. No birth, no inscription, just cold, as the man calls it. And the man checked with the cemetery records and supposedly died in 1922. So I'm not sure why the tomb says 1913.
Yeah.
And he mentions that there's a story, the story goes, that W.W. Poole was run out of England in the 1800s for allegedly being a vampire. John Gary also mentioned that he has always heard that Satanists, I'm saying it, I'm quoting, I'm doing air quotes here, come to his tomb every Halloween and chant incantations. Nothing else is said about W.W. Poole in this book. Very short chapter, but it was enough to make me go, okay, I've heard of something called the Richmond Vampire before, which is this W.W. Poole legend. So I'm going to go into that. First, I just started looking for W.W. Poole, and I found something called findagrave.com. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so began looking into WW Poole that way. And his name was William Wortham Poole. He was born April 10th, 1841 in Mississippi. In 1861, when he was 19, he volunteered for the Confederate Army. He became ill while on furlough and was issued a certificate of sickness on November 1st, 1861. He remained on the roll through September 28th, 1862, where after that, there's no more record. It also listed that he died on February 26, 1922, which is what John Gary said in his letter to the author. So he was accurate about the date. I'm still curious why it says 1913, though. I couldn't find a reason why. Maybe you bought it then, but why would you put the... Yeah, I don't know. On findgrave.com, it also lists that he had a wife and four children, and said he was an accountant that died at the age of 80. Another article I read called him a bookkeeper. I think that's the same thing as an accountant. And that he died of pneumonia. So that's possibly the real William Wortham Poole. But like I said, no details on the grave. And if he was just an accountant with a bunch of kids, why does he have a giant white granite tomb?
Yeah.
It's like, it's you got to look at it. It's like really big and over the top, and but no details. Really weird. So now let's go into the legend of the Richmond Vampire.
Let's do it.
So there was a very deadly tunnel collapse in 1925 known as the Churchill Train Tunnel. It originally opened in 1875. It was constructed during the Civil War, and it was used to connect the railway in Richmond to the shipping port known as Rocket's Landing. So Churchill had to be tunneled through, but it was made out of mud and clay, so it was bad for tunneling. It collapsed several times during its construction in the 1870s, and eventually in the early 1900s, they just closed it down because it kept collapsing and it was costing too much money. But as the town got bigger, they reopened the tunnel and refurbished it. Now, at this time, trains were a little bigger than when they first made it, so they had to expand it and reinforce it. And that's when it collapsed, on October 2nd, 1925. So it said that about 200 workmen crawled under the flat cars and escaped. There was a nine-day rescue effort to dig through the tunnel and get, like, the trapped locomotive. And the only body they found was engineer Tom Mason. A local news Halloween special that I'll link. It's really goofy and funny. It says that many of the men had to run about a mile to the east portal of the tunnel. Witnesses said during this time, there was a creature running out of the tunnel, nearly naked, with flesh dripping and burning eyes. The legend also states that the creature was chased to Hollywood Cemetery, where it retreated into W.W. Poole's tomb.
What?
Now, this other article I read by the Commonwealth Times states that it was most likely someone was injured crawling out of the tunnel with blood on their face and broken teeth. And it just got more exaggerated with every telling of the story. Now, that explains the sighting at the tunnel, but definitely not the link to W. Is there a crow inside our chimney? That sounded like it was in our chimney. That was weird. So, back to what I'm saying. That explains the sighting at the tunnel, but definitely not the link to W.W. Poole's tomb.
Mm-hmm.
So, when I was looking for cemetery ghouls, I saw a comment on a YouTube video about a man named Chris Baker from Richmond. And he was a literal ghoul, which is like a grave robber, in the late 1800s in Richmond, Virginia. So grave robbing was like, it was just super common.
Oh, yeah.
To supply bodies to medical schools. So I read this article titled Chris Baker, the Ghoul of Richmond. So I'm just going to share little clip from that. Employed as a janitor at the Medical College of Virginia in the late 19th century, Baker, an African-American man who frequently donned a black skull cap over his balding head, was photographed on several occasions with medical students in the dissecting room. That particular relationship and his role in supplying the college with mostly African-American corpses unfortunately made him an outcast to members of his own race and prevented him from venturing far from the MCV campus during his post-grave robbing years. So this whole article is about this man named Chris Baker.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the term ghoul is used for, like, grave robbers.
Yeah.
Back then. And this talks about how, like, before this certain law that passed, they would use grave robbers a lot. And then eventually a law passed where they could get, like, unspoken for bodies or unclaimed bodies,
mm-hmm.
Prisoners, things like that. They would do this in the name of science. But Chris Baker, he got known for it. One, because of his, he had a big arrest in 1882. In December, he was with his assistant and then two of the white medical students.
Mm-hmm.
And all four of them got caught robbing graves.
Wow.
The article says Baker and his associates pled guilty to a lesser misdemeanor and were sentenced to 6 months in jail, but all four were pardoned by the governor and set free by the end of the month.
What?
So all the faculty and everything from the college petitioned to get them pardoned.
Wow.
Because in their mind, it's like a necessary evil.
Mm-hmm.
Baker was like a pariah to his community.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would just call him like a boogeyman and thought that he was like practicing black magic and claimed that he attended funerals to scope out potential subjects to get. And he feared, it says, he feared retribution at the hands of his peers and spent the majority of his time as a self-incarcerated man inside the medical school. So he, like, hardly left the college. This was pretty kind of wild. And there's even, like, a newspaper clipping of it in the mm-hmm. article. But on October 30th, 1883, Baker and fellow Resurrection Man, so they would call him that, or Resurrectionists a lot, or mm-hmm. ghouls, William Burnett, were caught rolling an allegedly stolen almshouse corpse in a wheelbarrow brazenly through the Richmond streets. So the night before Halloween in 1883,
wow.
They're caught with a body in a wheelbarrow. And that was a real newspaper clipping of, you know how when you can read about things people get arrested for?
Yeah.
It was like one of those. So that really happened.
It's bold.
The article talks a lot about, like, fact or fiction with his life. But there's a lot of newspaper clippings
mm-hmm.
that you can read through in the article. Like I said, he didn't really leave the college.
Mm-hmm.
He died in his home on campus on June 8th, 1919, buried in an unknown location on the grounds of Richmond's Evergreen Cemetery. Most reports indicate that he was around 70 when he died, which is remarkable considering the amount of time he spent around the toxic chemicals involved in preserving bodies and organs.
Didn't even think about that.
Yeah, he spent a lot of time, like in the beginning I said, there's a lot of pictures of him in the dissecting room. It was said that he knew as much about anatomy as the medical students.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so wild, like, how common grave robbing for medical science was. I know we've talked about it a little bit, but it just kind of blows my mind. Like I said, many felt it was a necessary evil to move medical science forward. But at the end of the article, it also brings up this point. Respected by some and hated by others, Chris Baker went down in the history with the stigma of a ghoul, while some of his white grave robbing partners went on to become prosperous surgeons and doctors.
Mm.
So that's also a good point, is
yeah.
that they were all doing this,
mm-hmm.
but they went on to become doctors and surgeons, and he was just labeled a ghoul
yeah.
and had to kind of hide away. And the article also says, despite this, his contributions towards the advancement of medical science are worthy of appreciation and further exploration. I thought that was an interesting ending sentence. So, like I said, some people were really disturbed by it. Some people were like, you got to do it.
Yeah. But the other ones are not really remembered by name. So it is not fair in that aspect where, you know, he's kind of this whole pariah for it. And they just benefited career-wise off of it.
So, yeah, very interesting article. I'll link that in the show notes. And you can learn about Chris Baker and decide for yourself whether he was a ghoul or a necessary evil. So I found this cemetery ghoul vampire topic just super interesting. And of course, it made me think of something that I was only like slightly familiar with, known as the Highgate Vampire. So this is a wild tale of sightings and mass hysteria from the 1970s in London, England. It has to be broken down into several sections and has already led me down some really interesting rabbit holes. So next episode, I'll start to dive into what is known as the Highgate Vampire.
Ooh. On December 12th of 2021, a video was posted online of what looks like a light orb floating on a residential street. The light ball appears from behind a parked car, then quickly drops down to the ground. Chris Romer, chairman of the Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomenon, claims it is one of the best orb sightings of 2021. Chris says, "It's amazing. It's a real mystery why the light dropped." Chris suggests it's not paranormal, rather a person carrying a cell phone with a flashlight on, and their body is unseen due to the poor lighting on the street. The woman who captured the footage on an outdoor camera said the sighting was a mystery, but she does not believe in paranormal things. The woman notes that a neighbor's camera did not pick up the orb on their outside camera, and another neighbor says that long before the neighborhood was there, the area used to be a factory that made bricks, and the workers wore head torches. So, it could be a ghost of one of them. Dr. Becky Smith, a parapsychologist, wasn't so sure about the claims of it being a ghost. Is it the ghost of a long-gone worker? Or simply someone with a flashlight on an evening walk? Check out the video in our show notes and tell us what you think.
Liminal Earth has started a Wednesday night UFO watch club. This even includes printable punch cards for anyone interested in taking part of the experiment. In a TikTok posted by Liminal Earth, Garrett Kelly, one of the founding members, states, "The best time to see a UFO is supposedly Wednesday night at 10 p.m. So we're going to put that to the test." This idea stems from some of John Keel's findings shared in his book, Operation Trojan Horse from 1970. Keel writes, "As soon as I had organized the sightings by dates, the first significant pattern became apparent. This was that sightings tended to collect around specific days of the week. Wednesday had the greatest number of sightings, and these were usually reported between the hours of 8 to 11 p.m. If the UFO phenomenon had a purely psychological basis, then there should be more sightings on Saturday night, when more people are out of doors, traveling to and from entertainments, etc. Instead, we find that the greatest number of sightings are reported on Wednesday, and then they slowly taper off through the rest of the week. The lowest number occurs on Tuesday. This inexplicable Wednesday phenomenon proved very valid and was repeated through 1967 and 1968. It was later found to be valid, with minor variations in other countries." Check the show notes for links to club cards and see how to join the Wednesday Night UFO Watch Club for yourself.
On On January 30th, 2022, a video made its way online that shows a fisherman in Rio Grande do Sul in Brazil being chased by a sea creature with glowing eyes. A mysterious creature can be seen jumping in and out of the water 10 times while chasing the fisherman's boat as a man tries to get ahead out of the creature's advances. The fisherman requests to remain anonymous, but states he felt the creature wanted to attack me. Some social media users reacted with horror at the clip, while others claimed it was just a seal. Take a look at the footage and tell us what you think.
We're going to end the episode with a tale from a past Stormy Night with John and Ami episode that I think relates perfectly to the cemetery ghoul rabbit hole.
In 1981, reports began to circulate about a vampire that had taken up residence in Mineral Point's Graceland Cemetery. Initial reports of activity in the graveyard prompted Officer John Pepper to investigate while patrolling the area one evening. Pepper entered the cemetery and began to make his rounds when he saw a tall, caped figure with a white face. The vampire, startled by this intrusion, fled from the officer, who by instinct only gave chase until he saw the creature leap over a 6-foot barbed wire fence. The officer stopped in his tracks and returned to his squad car to make the report. He and a group of officers would return to the scene in the morning and attempt to follow the creature's tracks in the still fresh snow. When Pepper led his companions to the area where the vampire had escaped, there were no tracks found on the opposite side of the fence. Not much more would come of the event other than some ribbing by fellow officers. The story fell silent for quite some time until March 14, 2004, when police responded to several reports of someone sitting in a tree outside of an apartment complex, and they would leap upon his victims as they passed to enter. The description given by witnesses matched John Pepper's suspect from the Graceland Cemetery case. The creature remained at the scene until police arrived. They reported that a 6-foot caped figure leapt from the tree and fled. The police gave chase only to find that the footprints disappeared at a 10-foot concrete wall. The area was scoured, but not a sign of the creature was found beyond the concrete wall. Once again, the story fell silent until July 11, 2008, when police were dispatched again when a terrified young couple arrived at the station to report a tall caped figure with a white face had chased them. The witnesses, a young couple that were fishing off a jetty at Ludden Lake, reported that they had heard noises coming from behind them while fishing from the jetty. The couple stated that there was scratching under the wooden surface and that they could hear splashing and something climbing beneath them. One of the witnesses, Brandon Hines, stood and began to stomp on the jetty, thinking it was an animal and the noise would scare it away. He reported that the stomping only drew the creature closer to them. He shined a flashlight between the boards of the jetty to see the caped figure climbing up beneath them. He froze in horror as his girlfriend Jamie Marker fled the scene. When the creature approached, Hines threw the flashlight at it and fled behind Marker to their parked car, where she sat waiting for him with the doors locked. Hines entered the car and started the motor. He could see the caped figure speeding towards them as he jammed the car in gear. The couple fled to the Mineral Point police station to file their report. Two patrol units were dispatched to the site, but found nothing other than the young couple's fishing gear that was all still accounted for, with the exception of the flashlight.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Anomalous Waves. If you like what you heard today, consider, you know, becoming a patron. You can do this at patreon.com/anomalouswaves, where you'll get a monthly spooky newsletter. Mm-hmm. You'll get access to all the original randomly generated rabbit holes, which I think there's 7 of them. We are moving our side series, Randomly Generated Rabbit Holes, to the main feed. Right in front of this episode, or right before this episode, is the first one that we put out on the main feed. And we talk about the Jersey Devil. That was really fun.
Oh, yeah.
So our next randomly generated rabbit holes is going to be covering a topic that Ami chose, theater phantoms. You'll also get access to our bonus series, Stormy Night with John and Ami. This is where we just collect random accounts and stories that we find interesting, and we read them to you during a stormy night. We have full interviews up with people who have shared their experiences, extended movie reviews. You'll get early access to every episode we put out. And if you become a patron, you also get a shout out from Lilliput. So this one is for our newest patron, my pal, Jesse. Thanks, man. If subscriptions is not your thing, but you still want to support the show, you can send us a cool story to anomalouswaves@gmail.com or to our Instagram at anomalouswaves. Follow us there. You can rate us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to your stuff. Or you can just tell someone about the show.
Tell a puck wedgie.
Tell your local mortician.
Tell anybody over 6 feet that you see.
Tell your local cemetery ghoul.
Tell a crow that gets stuck in your chimney.
But most of all, just tell anyone who likes anything weird. All right, thanks so much for listening. Bye.
Mashish. Lily.